The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
A year and a half into the pandemic, months into vaccine rollouts, and still, in some countries, COVID rates are spiking. In Russia, mistrust of the government is fueling the problem.
I think it's a disaster. And at some point, somebody will have to admit that it's a total disaster.
Also today, safely navigating daily life in Haiti.
You need to check with your friends, or maybe you're on a WhatsApp group, and you need to find out, hey, is there a protest on that route? Was there a shootout on that route?
I'm Marco Werman. Also in France, a far-right anti-Muslim presidential candidate is gaining popularity, and we meet the hottest new artist in Egypt.
Hello, I am Ada.
We'll tell you why Ada's sculptures are one of a kind. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. We begin today in France, where presidential election season is heating up. So far, next April's election has mostly been seen as a two-horse race between the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, and the well-known far-right candidate, Marine Le Pen. In the last few weeks, though, another person has emerged on the political stage. And as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, he is shaking things up.
63-year-old Eric Zemmour stands at 5 feet 4 inches. He wears business suits and has a receding hairline. And when he shows up to rallies, he's greeted like a superstar. At a recent appearance in Nîmes in southern France, it didn't take Zemmour long to bring up his favourite topic, the demise of France. The war has no name, but it's happening every day, Zemmour said. It's a religious war, and it's threatening us. The TV host blames Islam and immigration for most of France's troubles. He's been convicted of incitement to hatred twice, but the court rulings seem to have little effect. Here's Zemmour talking on CNews, a right-wing French channel last year, about young male migrants arriving in France.
Ils sont voleurs, ils sont assassins, ils sont violeurs, il faut les renvoyer.
They're thieves, they're murderers, they're rapists, and we have to send them back, he said. The network was fined for airing those comments, but Zemmour, who's a presenter on the station, kept his job. In recent weeks, his name has been in the news in France constantly, and he hasn't even officially declared he's running for the presidency yet. The latest opinion polls put Zemmour neck and neck with far-right party leader Marine Le Pen.
He's an entertainer. People have seen him on TV for a very long time, exactly like Mr. Trump, and explains why his opinion polls are rocketing.
Vincent Martigny is professor of political science at the University of Nice. He says Zemmour appeals to a particular kind of right-wing voter in France.
He comes from the world of the classical right. In a certain way, this right-wing public is attracted to him in a way that they never were with Marine Le Pen, because Marine Le Pen appeared as too centred on the Le Pen family, the Front National. That was very extreme for them. But they are ready to buy somebody with the same idea, but with a different name.
Marine Le Pen has tried for years to soften the image of her political party, which was founded by her father, the far-right extremist Jean-Marie Le Pen. But now with Zemmour, she faces a new threat from someone whose views are even more extreme than her own. Zemmour has suggested that Muslim first names be banned for children born in France. A TV reporter asked him recently, if he became president, would parents still be able to give their kids non-French names?
No. Il peut le donner en deuxième prénom.
No, Zemmour said. They can have a non-French middle name instead. In fact, the president doesn't have the right to introduce such a ban. But these sorts of comments keep Zemmour in the headlines, even though he's openly hostile to most news outlets. At a weapons fair in Paris yesterday, he picked up an assault rifle on display and aimed it at a reporter's face. Move back, he said, laughing at the journalist's obvious discomfort. Zemmour likes to portray himself as someone who's outside the mainstream. But sociologist Nasira Ghanif at Paris 8 University says that simply isn't true.
He's very much an insider, actually. He has been part of major news networks such as the Figaro. He has been prominent on a TV program for many years. And I think that it has been quite a long time that he had a sense of his own importance.
The latest opinion polls show President Macron with a comfortable lead. Emmanuel Riviere is director of international polling with the research institute Kantar Public. He says if Zemmour really wants to compete with Macron, he needs to show that there's more to him than just populist rhetoric.
Sooner or later, people will ask about Eric Zemmour. Does he have the qualification to run a country and not only to share my views and to express my feelings about important topics?
Nonetheless, sociologist Nasir Ganif says Zemmour has already changed the political landscape in France.
Even if he doesn't run for the presidency, it means that the deeper roots of what he's playing with and the kind of game he's playing right now are here to stay. And this is much more concerning for me.
For now, Eric Zemmour appears to be enjoying the media spotlight. But he's still in search of the 500 signatures from elected officials across France that he needs to get his name on the ballot. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
An update now on the ongoing situation in Haiti. The leader of a Haitian gang that abducted 17 North American missionaries last weekend has put out a video message. This afternoon, Wilson Joseph said on social media that he will kill the hostages if his demands are not met. Wilson's criminal gang is demanding a ransom of $1 million per person for their release. The FBI and State Department continue to work to free the missionaries, but few details are coming out. Earlier today, I spoke with The World's Monica Campbell, who's reporting in the town of Pestel, Haiti. Monica, kidnapping for ransom is a widespread problem across Haiti, and this case of the missionaries has drawn global attention, it seems, because foreigners were abducted. But for Haitians, this is an everyday threat. What have people been telling you about that?
Yeah, I haven't talked to a single person who hasn't been affected by extreme violence, including kidnapping. The powerful gangs here in the country, they see kidnapping increasingly as a crime of opportunity. If there's something, you know, to fleece from you, whether it's a little bit of cash or a car or a large ransom, you can be a target. And it's also not something you can easily shield yourself from. I spoke with one man. His name is Neftali Augustin, and he's a dad. He runs a commercial photography business in Port-au-Prince. And earlier this year, he was driving home after visiting his mom with his two brothers, and a police officer pulled him over, or at least he thought it was a police officer. Turned out that that police officer was part of a group of gang members there, pulled him out of the car, and took them hostage.
Oui, nous fait pratiquement 4 jours en dedans côté que yo séquestré nous dans petit salle là et petit salle ça c'est li servi à la fois d'entrepreneur.
So he's telling me how the kidnappers took him and his brothers into a small room in this gang controlled area of town with others in that room had been kidnapped, and it was also a room piled with stolen goods like purses and car stereos and also with objects that the kidnappers were using to torture people in captivity. And they were held in that room for 4 days until Neftali and his brothers managed to ask everyone they know to help pay off that ransom. And they were set free after paying off the ransom. They lost their car because apparently the kidnappers used their car to kidnap more people. And he's still paying off that ransom debt. And he's still living in Port-au-Prince.
And the kidnappers are being driven by what, Monica?
It's money. It's power. They have control over large swaths of this country. The police aren't entering these gangland territories. It seems they're operating with complete impunity.
So, Monica, you're speaking to us from the city of Pestel. That part of Haiti was badly affected by the massive earthquake earlier this year. Describe what you're seeing there now.
Sure. So I wanted to come to this small fishing village, and it took a while to get here. We flew from Port-au-Prince to another part of the country in the southern peninsula, got in a 4x4, and then what should have been a relatively smooth ride along a new highway was intense. Massive boulders were in the road that we had to maneuver around. Mudslides the whole way. The entire drive up, you just, you know, lined with tents of all forms, people living in these tents, afraid to go back into their homes if they have a home to go back into. in this fishing village, people are basically without work. They're without homes and they're milling around, and it's an increasingly desperate situation.
So that earthquake was in August, and those roads are covered still with rubble. You had a video on Twitter that was just extraordinary. I mean, this is several months later, and it's still the same situation, basically, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, the boulders were the size of, like, small trucks. I've never seen such devastation on a road before. And getting the equipment to this place, it's going to take a very long time. It's a huge effort that has to happen. And of course, there's been a lot of humanitarian aid coming to Haiti, but that's also being complicated because in a way you sort of have to think about Haiti right now sort of split in two. There's Port-au-Prince and then there's the rest of Haiti. And getting around outside of Port-au-Prince, you have to negotiate through gang territory. So I flew to the airport to get near the fishing town. I couldn't drive from Port-au-Prince, you know, which would have been several hours, might have made sense back in the day. Mm. There's no way I was going to drive, and it was like no-go zone. So the humanitarian aid is also dealing with complications of getting around the country because of the gang situation here. It's just precarious to get anything transported around this country. They have a lot of control.
There's another video I saw at a gas station, Monica, and it's just one motorcycle after another waiting for gas. Nobody's filling up. That seems to suggest shortages of gas. What are you seeing?
So key points of distribution for gas and fuel in Haiti are in gangland territory, and they're exerting their control. This is a major power play. What we're seeing, they're saying, you know, to the government, you're going to have to negotiate with us. We're going to need to be paid if you're going to want to have this country running. And they are effectively starting to shut parts of this country down. Now we're starting to see frustration build up because people can't get to work. People are wondering, you know, how am I going to live if I can't put some gas in my motorcycle? In fact, at this fishing village, I was asking folks here, you know, how are you seeing this trickle down? They said, well, have you seen many motorcycles around? And I've seen a couple. But they said, usually that's how we're all getting around to where we need to work and to larger places where there's employment. And people can't get gas in their motorcycle. So we're starting to see protests because, of course, if you don't have gas, you can't fuel your generator. Mm. You know, what's that going to do to a hospital, right? How is that going to start trickling down to some other things shutting down in the country?
What else are gangs in Haiti able to control? And what does that mean for Haitians practically?
So however you're moving around, especially in Port-au-Prince, you need to think it through. If you're usually taking one route to get downtown or to your job, you need to check with your friends or maybe you're on a WhatsApp group and you need to find out, is something popping on that route? Is there a protest on that route? Was there a shootout on that route? Okay, I'm going to take an alternative route. My entire time in Port-au-Prince has been just a series of calculations of whether one place is safe or one route is safe. People I talk to, everybody from Haiti, they're saying this is one of the most complicated, difficult moments they've experienced. You have many things happening at once. You have a recovery from the earthquake. You have an assassinated president. You have gangs exerting intense control over swaths of the country. You have an economy, you know, still struggling from the pandemic greatly. And you have people who've been deported back to Haiti who are now wondering, you know, what are they going to do? And I'm here in this small fishing village because people here are organizing to leave, to go to the United States. So while we're having people return to Haiti, be deported back to Haiti, we are having new people actively planning to leave the country.
There was Monica Campbell on the ground in Pestel, Haiti. Thank you very much, Monica, for your reporting.
You're welcome.
I mentioned the photos and videos that Monica has been sharing. You can see those on her Twitter feed. She's at @Monica_Campbell. We'll have more of Monica's reporting from Haiti in the coming days. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. India today reached a major milestone. 1 billion people have now received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. It's being called the biggest vaccination drive in the world. Dr. Brahmar Mukherjee has been following the ups and downs in India. Mukherjee is a professor of epidemiology and global health at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. So 1 billion doses administered. In your view, doctor, is this a milestone for India?
This is definitely a milestone, but you have to see things in retrospect and also in view of the entire context of the trajectory of the pandemic in India. But definitely, I don't want to take this moment away, but I also want to reflect on the journey.
Yeah. So what do you think changed since earlier this year? I mean, February to June, India was caught up in a major COVID surge due to the emerging Delta variant.
Yes. So if you look at the vaccination drive, India had the first vaccines approved right about at the same time in January as the rest of the world. But the start of the vaccination program was actually quite sluggish. In January and February, I was talking to my family and friends about getting vaccinated, but they were talking about vacations as opposed to vaccination. So there is this sense of complacency that the COVID is over. This is true. We are talking about February of 2021. And then slowly but surely, the curve started to rise. And we saw that virus inferno due to the Delta surge in April and May. So had the vaccination been this prompt, this towering peak and incredible loss of human lives could have been prevented. So as much as I am happy that we have reached this milestone, I always wonder and think about, had we done this work ahead of time, we could have been in a better position.
At one time, Prime Minister Modi was criticized for being complacent about COVID. Now he's pushing mask use. Do you think he's learning on the job? Does he deserve ongoing criticism?
So I do think that, you know, we are all learning on the job, but I think that there was a lot of cautionary warning in February when scientists and the modeling team and public health experts were telling the government that the second surge is coming. And there was clear data denial and denial of scientific evidence at the time, not just really using caution, but elections were going on. There were massive rallies, there were religious gatherings, and then on top of that, this Delta surge, that was just a perfect storm, which led to the loss of human lives. So, you know, we are learning on the job. I always reflect back that the families that suffered, the families that lost loved ones who are never going to come back due to this whole societal and also policymakers' negligence and hubris and complacency, everything combined together. So, of course, there is a general awareness in the public as well to take COVID seriously. If you look at the death toll in India, 450,000 reported deaths, but the actual estimate from excess death calculations range from somewhere from 1.5 to about 4 million deaths. So the loss of lives, I think, has shaken the Indian society as well. So people are more cautious. And with the festival season coming, I think there is repeated need for cautionary alert so that we do not make the same mistake again. So I think we need to keep at it for the foreseeable future. So I hope that the Modi government and people in charge and in leadership enforces and transmits that message that it is not over until it's really over globally.
I'm curious, the fact that India is home to the Serum Institute, the largest vaccine hub in the world, how much did that help to have that on home turf and reaching 1 billion doses?
Yeah, so in the beginning, I think that there was a lot of glitch in terms of both orchestrating a deal and also sharing vaccine with other countries. And again, India was quite generous in terms of sharing and contributing vaccine doses back in February and March when the immediate threat was not perceived. But there was those initial glitches like, you know, we are writing the playbook as we are getting along. So I think those are all natural, but definitely having production capacity in-house really helped India to accelerate. We also have to remember that 1 billion doses is a huge milestone, but India is a very large population. This means that only 22% of India is fully vaccinated and 53% have at least one shot. So there is 47% people who have not received any vaccination. So we have a lot of work to do. As much as we celebrate, we cannot forget that we have a lot of work that remains ahead of us.
Dr. Brahmar Mukherjee is a professor of epidemiology and global health at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. Doctor, thank you very much for speaking with us again.
No, thank you so much.
There's a big international art exhibition going on right now in Egypt at the Pyramids of Giza. It's called Forever is Now.
We invite artists, galleries, institutions from around the world to be part of this historical moment.
One artist in Egypt had some logistical issues getting there, and when I say artist, I'm using air quotes. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
She's an artist of sorts. Ada, that's spelled A-I-D-A.
I am Ada, the world's first ultra-realistic AI robot artist.
Ada is a robot that draws portraits. She's named after Ada Lovelace, who's widely considered to be the world's first computer programmer. And the name is a play on AI, artificial intelligence. Get it? A-I-D-A? She was developed by engineers at the University of Leeds in England. She looks like an animatronic on an old-school ride at Disney's Epcot Center. Just creepier.
This is Spaceship Earth Control. On behalf of Siemens, welcome aboard.
It's pretty cool how Ada works. There are cameras in Ada's eyes which take pictures of her subject. Those images are then processed through AI algorithms and translated into coordinates, which Ada then draws on paper using her robotic arm. But she's a long way from this.
Maybe there's a happy tree. He lives right there. Look at that. Isn't that a nice little tree?
Last year, Ada's creators programmed her to give a TEDx talk at Oxford, where she waxed philosophical.
New technologies bring good, bad, and banal, but since they are created, used, and wielded by humans, significant care needs to be taken.
For the exhibit in Egypt, Ada got a significant upgrade. She's learned how to sculpt. She created a clay statue inspired by the Riddle of the Sphinx. Ada, along with the art, was en route from her home in England to Egypt when she was detained at customs. The robot's creator, Aidan Meller, said Egyptian officials thought Ada was a spy. Partly it was those cameras in her eyes that freaked him out. Meller said the British ambassador had to get involved. That was neither confirmed nor denied by the embassy. Whatever the ambassador said, or didn't say, worked, because Ada is now in Giza after 10 days of being impounded. Meller said he'd always hoped his project would prompt debate about the rapid rise of AI technology, but this wasn't exactly what he had in mind. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
More from around the globe coming your way in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. Coming up, a French musician with roots in the Caribbean was given an old letter, proof of his great-great-grandmother's freedom from slavery.
I felt like, I don't know, I was given one key to where I came from.
And inspired a lot of new music. That and more elemental headaches for car makers still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Russia, COVID cases and deaths are skyrocketing, reaching their highest level since the start of the pandemic. Today, Moscow's mayor announced that the capital would soon go into a one-week lockdown. That's after Russian President Vladimir Putin declared a nationwide week-long workplace shutdown. Mikhail Fishman is in Moscow. He's a Russian journalist and host of the independent TV program Dozhd. So these new COVID rules in Moscow will be the strictest since spring of 2020. How are Muscovites responding?
Officially, 1,000 deaths is a daily average, though experts claim the real number is three times as high based on data of excessive deaths during last year. And the last available data is August, but in October, they expect more or less the same, three times as high death rate due to COVID. Moscow is probably better protected than rest of Russia. It's better vaccinated, but still, as experts say, Russia has never gone through such a loss of its population since probably World War II.
Well, it's interesting, the week-long national work stoppage that the Kremlin announced, apparently it's a week that already included four national holidays. So for the most part, people weren't going to go to their places of work anyway. Have you heard from experts about what this one-week lockdown will actually do to the COVID numbers?
What we did hear from the experts is that one-week lockdown never helps, really. What you need to break the surge, you need at least 3 weeks of lockdown. But we also know that the authorities, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin personally, never was for any lockdown, because he felt from the very beginning, from when he announced it for the first time, and he never calls it lockdown, it's officially called nationwide holiday, paid days off. He would never even mention a word lockdown in Russian. So he thinks that it harms him politically. It breaks the trust that he has from the population, from the nation, because nation is almost always against any strict measures. They do feel financial loss every time. Putin always puts his political goals in front of other issues, would it be COVID or whatever. So people see that the pandemic is political, that the virus is political. That's why the nation is almost always against any lockdown measures. So Putin apparently finally understood that the numbers that we have now are so catastrophic that there's no other way.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for the Kremlin to ignore the numbers now. Deaths in Russia are topping 1,000 a day. Yesterday, President Putin sounded really exasperated. Putin saying here, I can't understand what's going on. We have a reliable and efficient vaccine. I should say, last spring, Putin reportedly got two jabs of vaccine, not publicly, and the Kremlin would not say which one. Then yesterday, Putin admitted even his close friends are delaying the shot. How do you think Putin is handling this crisis?
I think it's a disaster. And at some point, somebody will have to admit that it's a total disaster, that no big nation in the world has gone through such numbers of human loss and COVID cases. Putin personally declared victory over COVID already a few times, three for sure. And now we are at our worst surge of cases since the start of the pandemic. So it's a total disaster. And even now, though he already admits, he understands that the situation is very grave. If you look at what's going right now, when Putin is speaking in front of the Valdai Forum in Sochi, you would see that hardly anyone wears a mask. He never did, and no one does.
Then there's the vaccine side of the equation. I mean, you alluded to this earlier. Only about a third of Russians are fully vaccinated. Are many people you know, Mikhail, skeptical about the vaccine?
Among my circle, I think that most people already understand that vaccine saves lives, can save their own life, can save lives of their relatives, of close ones. Though still, from time to time, I run into people. And for example, I say that I've been already revaccinated and it really helps and so on. And they get really like, oh, really? Do you trust this stuff? You must be a very brave man. Something like this, you know? Right. And it's very strange because I get it from people that I would never think I would get. I understand that there are COVID dissidents. I understand that it's a global sort of problem. But in Moscow, a very, I'd say, civilized city, you would run into such a type of a COVID dissident very, very often.
Well, Russia,
strangely, very often.
Russia has Sputnik V and three other domestic vaccines, but I know Western-made vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna are often criticized in state-controlled media. Do you think that's making Russians skeptical of vaccines in general?
I think that it's a complicated issue, that it's more of a problem of distrust between the nation and its government. It's coming from the above. It's something that they up there think we should do. We do not know, is it true or not? Because they definitely lie. The COVID campaign in Russia was based on lies from the very start. The official data is rigged and false. And the Kremlin, Putin himself, always treated the situation as not really serious. And Russia is doing better than any other part of the world. That's almost a direct quote. So why bother? Why do we have to follow their demands? Why would I look throughout the window and think that something that happens to a stranger across the street can happen to me? Stuff like that. It's a complicated thing.
Are you saying, Mikhail, that the Russian public has lost trust in the government's ability to handle the COVID crisis, and in turn they're losing wholesale trust in the Kremlin?
I think that it's more like the nation understands that it's on its own and it has to fight with it itself. People have to deal with what they deal with, and the government will never help.
Throughout the pandemic, the message from Russian leaders has been, we're free and open while the rest of the world is in lockdown or shutdown. Now it seems it's backtracking. Where do you think this goes next for the Kremlin?
That depends on the numbers. As I understand, they expect the peak of this surge in a week or two. 1 week lockdown will hardly help, but does it mean that the surge will keep growing? We don't know yet. We know what will bother Kremlin, the Kremlin and the authorities. It's when they see the crisis will be visible on the street, when there are queues and lines of ambulances with people dying and not getting their help in the hospitals, the lack of places in COVID hospitals, when the crisis breaks down to the streets, when it becomes visible, because you can't see the virus itself. it's too little, too small. So that's when the Kremlin really starts bothering.
Mikhail Fishman in Moscow. He's host of the independent TV program Dozhd and the former editor-in-chief of the Moscow Times, speaking with us about Russia's latest outbreak of COVID cases. Mikhail, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As soon as he took office, President Biden promised to reverse many of the immigration policies of his predecessor. But there's only so much power a president has, and the courts are now stopping Biden from getting rid of one key piece of Trump-era policy. The World's Daisy Contreras explores the impact of that on asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Several kids wearing face masks lean over small plastic buckets filled with dirt. They're planting seeds for a science fair project.
Hay tierra todavía.
There's more dirt over there, a woman calls out. The kids are in a makeshift school in the Mexican city of Reynosa, right near the U.S. border, about 15 miles south of McAllen, Texas. They're asylum seekers living in a migrant tent camp, waiting for updates on when their asylum cases might be heard by a judge. Felicia Rangel Zamponaro oversees the classrooms through a nonprofit, The Sidewalk School. She says it's a tough living situation for migrants.
You're talking about people, 2,000 people who live out in the open amongst cartels. So kidnappings happen on a daily basis. Assaults against asylum seekers, that happens on a daily basis as well.
The kids and their families are being kept on the Mexico side of the border before their asylum cases are heard. That's because a U.S. policy known as Remain in Mexico is in limbo. The Biden administration tried ending it in June, but a federal court ordered the program to continue. The Supreme Court upheld that decision. Now the Biden administration plans to officially restart it next month. But Mexico needs to agree to that first, says Chris Ramon. He's an immigration and border policy analyst in D.C.
So I think that one of the options that the administration may be banking on is seeing whether or not Mexico could actually bail it out.
Mexican officials are asking for a revamped program, Ramon says, one that makes sure asylum seekers are safe, have access to lawyers, and get their cases resolved within 6 months. But Ramon thinks Mexico might not want to continue the program. The country is already facing criticism with how it's dealt with migrants at the southern border with Guatemala.
They don't want to have to be responsible for more migrants coming into the country on top of the individuals who are already entering Mexico.
Taylor Levy, an immigration attorney who's worked with asylum seekers, says she's worried. She doesn't want Remain in Mexico to be reinstated, even with changes. There's already a huge backlog in courts, she says.
And that's exactly what we're going to see happen again. Apart from that, trying to rush people through a fundamentally unfair process does not make the process more fair.
On top of that, attorneys face a lot of dangers, Levy says. There aren't many attorneys willing to travel to Mexico and take these cases if the program resumes, including herself.
I mean, the work that I was doing with asylum seekers was utterly soul-crushing, and it was terrifying. I was directly threatened by the cartels. I was followed.
The Biden administration says it will try to halt the program again in a way that can hold up in court. Still, those in support say the administration should pressure Mexican officials to resume Remain in Mexico, like President Donald Trump did when he threatened tariffs on Mexico if officials didn't comply. Meantime, the work at the border continues for Felicia Rangel Zamponaro. She says asylum seekers continue arriving at the camps every day. If Remain in Mexico is officially reinstated, they could be stuck there for months or years. She's holding off on letting them know about the status of the policy until it's official.
We're the ones that make those posters to inform asylum seekers, this is what's now happening. These are now your choices that you need to make now.
She says it's now up to Mexico to decide what happens next. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
There's another Trump-era policy keeping migrants in Mexico. It's called Title 42. It expels migrants as soon as they arrive in the U.S. without a chance to go to court. Unlike Remain in Mexico, it's a policy Biden does not want to end just yet. The administration says while the pandemic continues, Title 42 will be kept in place. That's causing a rift between Biden and immigration advocates who supported Biden on voting day. We'll continue following that here on The World. Magnesium, the chemical element, atomic number 12, as you may recall from high school, it is a key ingredient in making cars. Magnesium makes aluminum tougher and therefore cars lighter, which in turn increases gas mileage. Right now, there is a critical shortage of magnesium. China controls some 85% of the global supply, but it's cut production. Many analysts warn that this could cause even more supply chain disruptions to an already hampered auto industry. Abby Abraham is with the marketing and consulting firm Ducker International and specializes in automotive materials. Abby, how critical today is magnesium to the global auto industry?
Magnesium is a critical input towards lightweighting goals, as you had mentioned. There's actual magnesium applications within vehicles. Small parts as in housings for the display units, for instance, or some different control connectors. But there's also magnesium large castings that are utilized in vehicles. In fact, almost 11 kilograms of magnesium content is in a typical average North American produced light vehicle today.
11 kilos, that's about 22, 23 pounds. Wow, that's incredible.
Right.
So what is going on in China that's causing this shortage of magnesium?
From our research and from our offices in Shanghai, what we've learned is that there's a price inversion of coal and electricity that's taking place. Price of coal has been increasing based on the demand factors for electricity in the region, while prices for electricity seems to be controlled at a certain point by the government as well, too. So you have a demand-supply imbalance, which is causing these disruptions. The production of magnesium and aluminum, converting the raw material into the finished product that we utilize, takes a significant amount of electricity. As a matter of fact, aluminum is known as taking a very high amount of energy to convert into. Therefore, producers of magnesium and other raw materials are curtailing their production to kind of sort of balance the demand cycle.
Are these producers literally shutting down smelters and factories that produce magnesium?
You know, I think from what we understand, it's curtailing the production. There might be a detrimental effect of shutting down smelters completely. So you slow it down to a point where it limits the amount of production that could be produced.
Is it also partly to reduce CO2 emissions? Is that also driving the slowdown in magnesium production?
From what I understand, the CO2 concept for magnesium production, as you think about the sources of energy production, you know, renewables, nuclear, or other forms of energy production has a play within it. But I haven't heard that as a top reason in terms of what's happening. I think it's simply because of the supply-demand balance as it relates to coal and the total amount of electricity required for the region.
It's kind of stunning that China controls 85% of the global supply of magnesium. How did China come to be the world's dominant supplier of it?
Magnesium, from a raw material standpoint, is an abundant supply in China and other parts of the world. What's different is that the production methodology that China utilizes to produce magnesium is different than what we see here in the United States, for instance. Environmental concerns are a lot more, you know, untolerated here in the U.S., so there's a different production method that requires a lot more refining and capabilities that adds up to the cost of domestic U.S.-produced magnesium. So, given that fact, if other parts of the world have higher cost to produce magnesium, China de facto becomes the primary producer because they're lower cost compared to other parts of the world.
So it is important to diversify suppliers, but can auto manufacturers get their magnesium from countries besides China right now, or are they simply stuck?
China is not the primary importer or supplier of magnesium for North American consumption, or the U.S. consumption. As a matter of fact, Israel and Canada and Mexico together account for far more than half of the total import demand that's coming in. So there's several other countries that are producing magnesium and supplying to the U.S. either directly or indirectly through Canada and Mexico as well, too.
So does that mean that the U.S. auto industry won't be affected by the shortage of magnesium in China?
Oh, hardly. No, I do believe that the ripple effect of what's happening in China, given their largest stake in terms of production, will make its way to the U.S. For consumers, you know, I think ultimately it's the transaction price of the vehicles will be reflective of certain pass-through costs. At a certain point, if raw material prices increase, that gets passed on. And the GMs, the Fords, the Stellantis, the VWs of the world may have to elect to turn around and share some of those costs with their consumers as well, too.
Abby Abraham with the marketing and consulting firm Ducker International in Michigan, speaking with us about the global shortage of available magnesium and its impact on the auto industry. Abby, thanks very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Marco.
A lot of the time you hear a band's name and you wonder, how on earth did they come up with that? The Paris-based blues rock trio Del Grasse chose a historical figure as their namesake. We'll get a short history lesson from the band's founder in a moment, but first, a taste of Del Grasse, the title track from their latest album, 4 AM. Now, about that name, Del Grasse. That would be Louis Del Grasse, born in 1766, a Creole officer in France's army in the Caribbean. Louis Del Grasse eventually switched sides and joined the resistance in Guadeloupe after Napoleon Bonaparte wanted to reinstitute slavery there. Here's Pascal Danaï, founder of the band Del Grasse, with more about the man at the source of their name.
He was born in Martinique. He was a mixed-race guy, and he died in Guadeloupe in 1802. You know, he was a soldier, and he believed really strongly in the principle of the French Revolution.
Pascal Danaï himself has roots in both Guadeloupe and France. He was born just outside Paris, but his ancestry is from the Caribbean archipelago. Pascal, when your fellow Guadeloupians hear the name Del Grasse, what do they associate your music with? Is it kind of a sort of rebel music?
Yeah, most people associate it to, of course, because he was a rebel. So people would go like, you know, this is music where you try to fight the system and all that. In one way it is, but the reason why I picked that name is because I'm from Guadeloupean origins and I didn't know about the guy until very late in my life. He's a hero in that island. So I decided to kind of pay tribute to him and through his story, kind of go back to Guadeloupe, find my roots back and reclaim that.
That history is very real for you, Pascal. Some century and a half after the abolition of slavery in Guadeloupe, on your first trip there from Paris, you were handed a letter. Tell me what was in that letter.
Yeah, that was something, because the first time I went to Guadeloupe, you're right, an old cousin of my father handed me the letter of freedom of my grandmother, dated 1841.
So a letter, kind of an affidavit of her freedom from slavery.
Yes, wow. Absolutely. And I could read not only the name, but also the age. So Louise Danaï, 27, and of four children. And among them, my grandfather, Ulysse. He was 1 year old when he was freed. And all of a sudden, all those stories you hear become so real. You know, it's like, wow. Then you can touch the thing, you know. And I guess that was part of what... later would lead me to write that music. That's the whole Del Grasse thing.
I was just about to ask you, musically, where did that letter send you? But, I mean, more to the point, what were you feeling when you first held that piece of paper?
Well, I felt like, I don't know, I was given one key to where I come from. Because, you know, when you grow up from West Indian parents in France, mainland, you feel very French. The other part of you is like, you know, you eat rice and peas and you have all these people speak Creole around you. But all of a sudden, you go there, you see that letter, and then everything becomes real. Another part of you is taking shape. That was really deeply moving, of course, as you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. So the new album, 4AM, the record release party for it was a concert in a way, a performance of the album, and you filmed it in a nameless factory somewhere in France where the workers have all been fired. And as artists, yeah. Delgres is there to entertain and energize a revolt. I mean, this is all the conceit. I'm just curious, though, what relationship does Delgres, the band, have to the labor movement in France?
4AM is the time where my father, when he moved to France, he used to wake up at 4 a.m. to go and work as a labor guy. You know, he was working in factories and stuff. So the first song is called 4 heures matin, which is 4 a.m. We filmed the first video in a harbor when he actually arrived in France, in Le Havre. And we are surrounded by working people. And because that's where we come from, most of us in the band. You know, so we kind of pay tribute to these guys through my personal history and the story of my father.
Working people in the factory who are grooving to your music, I mean, we really get a sense of that in the album's track, Alea. We see you in the band and a whole parade of people with flags marching down a runway. What is the song Alea all about?
Oh, Alea is about separation. Because this is very much part of my personal history. Because my father moved to France in 58 with only two kids. He left my mother behind and three more kids. And of course, all my, you know, my siblings, they had to live because I was not born that yet. I was born when they were reunited.
When your mother came from Guadeloupe to France.
Yeah, when she came from Guadeloupe. So I guess I was like, you know, a happy ending. I don't know. but yes, so that separation and the fact that you see the people you love leave could be sometimes to go to another country. Sometimes it's because, you know, they just leave this world. And this is something we all have to live through at one point in our life. And that song is very much about that.
Is your father or your parents still with us?
No, they're not. They passed away.
I'm curious how you think your father would have reacted to the presentation of your music in this way.
Oh, I'm pretty sure he would be really proud. And the fact that I could shed some light on everything that he would just take as being normal, you know, that generation of people.
Things like what? What would he consider normal that you consider totally abnormal?
But he considered normal just the fact that, you know, you provide for your family. Our parents, grandparents, they would just like, you know, get up in the morning, go for it, provide for their family, and don't ask too many questions, you know. But sometimes it's just for us to stop for a while, look at them, and admire them for what they do, because this is not that easy. Sometimes, you know, this is a way of saying thank you.
Pascal Danet is the founder of the band Delgres. Their new album is 4 a.m. Thank you very much, Pascal. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
We built you a playlist with some tracks from Delgres, along with other artists we featured on the show. 4.5 hours of a lot of the great sounds you hear on The World. We posted a link to that playlist on our Twitter feed. It's easy to remember, we are at The World. And that's going to do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.